Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. Today, we're exploring ways we can continue to stay connected with each other, even when we're self-isolating for health reasons. We hear from students in Wales and West Virginia who have been exchanging audio diaries about their lives.
I do go visit places around Wales if it isn't raining. It rains a lot here. But Wales is a beautiful place.
One of my favorite things about West Virginia is watching the seasons change.
And getting outside is good for our health and well-being. It's also a great way to spend time with family, including our furry friends. And we'll listen back to our conversation with old-time fiddler John Morris about the way he learned to play old-time music.
You had to go to the old people to learn it. You had to win their respect. You had to be a friend to make a friend.
You'll hear those stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. If we've learned anything in this strange new world of coronavirus, it's that connecting with other human beings is vital to our mental health and well-being. But how do we maintain our connections with each other when we can't speak face-to-face? And how do we take care of ourselves and not stress about things beyond our control? That's what we're exploring today on Inside Appalachia. We're taking a much-needed break from the news, and we'll be spending the next hour exploring some fantastic places right here in our own backyard. We'll learn why fresh air and being in the forest can be good for our health, and why compassion and meditation can help us deal with anxiety. We start with a story that warms the heart so much because it helps address questions many of us might be struggling with. How do we connect with each other in this age of social distancing? And because it shows how much we share with people, even across the ocean. For the past few months, we've been working to mentor two groups of high school age kids. One group is in Lincoln County, West Virginia, and the other is in Merthyr Tydfil, Wales. The students have been exchanging audio diaries with one another. Our Inside Appalachia team is also planning a reporting trip to Wales later this year. Well, obviously, any kind of travel is on hold at the moment, but we hope to touch base and meet some of these students from Wales at some point in the future. For now, we're aiming to keep this collaboration going remotely. After all, young people have some of the most unique ways of understanding our culture and folkways. Anyway, here are some of the audio messages these two groups of young people have been exchanging with each other as a way to better understand our similarities with people in Wales.
Saturday, I'm Isaac Wall, and I live in Merthyr Tydfil in a place called Penyard. It was great to hear about you and what you like, etc. So here are a few things about me. Wales is my home, and it's the place I love, especially when the rugby is on. I stand by my boys no matter the result. My grandfather was in the army, and he was a coal miner. As you may know, we are known for our coal.
Maylon Sather, I am a 17-year-old girl. I know you may think that doesn't need clarification, but it is 1 o'clock in the morning, and I kind of sound like a little boy.
Most of the males in my family were or are coal miners. My dad, especially, he worked in the coal mines for 40 years, 20 years below ground, 20 years above ground.
Hello, my name's Jack, aka JLP. If you're wondering about how we worked in the coal mines, my family used to work in the steelworks, which was sort of related to the coal industry. And it wasn't until Margaret Thatcher came along and ruined everything about it. I wasn't born at the time, so I didn't vote.
I actually only have uncles that worked in the coal mines, and one got black lung and the other lost his job. So I think coal hasn't really done the family well. I'm actually against using coal as an energy source because our environment is going down the drain. That is just part of my democratic liberal beliefs, which basically means that I think everyone should have equal rights, should be able to do what they want with their body, and just everyone should accept and respect each other.
Hi, my name is Maddie. I'm 17. I spend my days eating plain pasta and Italian food. I'm a vegetarian, but I don't like vegetables. I'm a lesbian, and my girlfriend lives in England. We're in a long-distance relationship. I live in Ebervale at the moment, but I was born in a capital city called Cardiff. You may have heard of it.
Hi, my name is Bailey Tudor. My favorite thing about West Virginia is the Tudor's Biscuit World restaurant.
Hi, my name is Sam McCarthy. I'm 17 years old. I'm from Merthyr Tydfil. My favorite food is pizza, just plain pizza because I'm boring.
My name is Austin James. I'm 17 years old. In my free time, I usually like to play basketball. I'm a big Celtics fan. My favorite food has to be either chicken or pepperoni rolls.
Hi, my name is Ella. I'm 17 and I come from Merthyr Tydfil. My favorite snack is Doritos and salsa. My favorite film is Shaun of the Dead, and my favorite TV shows are Breaking Bad and Mr. Robot.
For fun, I like to stay home, chillax, listen to music, maybe hang out with friends. I like to play different types of instruments, so right now I'm learning how to play banjo.
I like animals and food, a lot of food. Well, not counting meat, rice, eggs, noodles, not spaghetti, potatoes, apart from chips, aka fries and mashed potato, and that's it.
My name is Lainey Atkins. I'm a 16-year-old junior at Lincoln County High School. I play soccer for the LCHS Lady Panthers. Out of school, I love to spend time with family and friends. Some of my favorite foods are breadsticks from Olive Garden, Chick-fil-A, and birthday cake.
My spare time, I really like my soccer. However, it is pronounced football over here and should be pronounced football globally. I do play my Xbox and play games like FIFA, Call of Duty, and games such as Spider-Man and Batman and other strategic games. I despise Fortnite with a passion, though no offense to anyone who plays it.
My name is Mackenzie and I'm 17. One of my favorite things about West Virginia is watching the seasons change. My biggest relationship to Cole would be watching some of my friends leave my school because their parents lost their jobs.
My favorite thing about Wales is the scenery. I like going to the Brecon Beacons, which is like mountains. I'm also very passionate about the things I love and will protect and feed my friends, sheltering them from all possible harm. Most famous people don't come here because it's isolated and irrelevant, just like me.
My favorite thing about Southern West Virginia is the people, because they are the kindest, hardworking, caring people you will meet. And regardless of who you are, where you come from, your background, they could care less and they'll treat you equal. And I think that's great.
Hi, my name is Sophie Higgins. I am currently 17, 18 soon. I have a dog called Bailey and a cat called Soxie, which I love loads. I do go visit places around Wales with my family on the weekends, if it isn't raining. It rains a lot here, but Wales is a beautiful place.
My favorite thing about Southern West Virginia has to be how pretty it can get at times. I really don't have a relationship with coal, but my dad works with the coal mines.
Some of us, me included, speak the native language of our country, which is Welsh. There's a village in North Wales which you may have heard of, or you may not have. It's called Llanfair Pwllgwyngyll Gerwchyddrobwy Ffantasiliol Gogogoch. And yeah, you heard that right. It's actually a place. You can Google it if you don't believe me. That's if you can spell it. It's the second longest place name in the world.
Right now and forever probably, I have just had this fire set under me where I want to do everything in my power to help this state, because I love the state and I love the people so much. And I want to do everything in my power to get to our root problems, like our poverty issues, our education system, the lack of young people in our state, all those things I just want to help with. And I think that covered all my bases. I think that means I can go to bed, and I'm going to do that. So this has been my time. Good night.
So that's me done. I hope you find this interesting, because many people don't, lol. It was great hearing from you guys, and I wish you all the best in your studies. Who knows, maybe we'll make a movie together. Have a good one, guys.
Anyway, that's my time, so I hope I didn't bore you to death. And I'm excited to hear about you, so bye.
Again, those were the voices of high school-age students in Lincoln County, West Virginia, sharing their experiences with students in Wales. It's part of a collaborative initiative with Inside Appalachia's Folkways Project. Stay tuned for more stories about our connections with folks in the British Isles later this year. For our next story, we're going to stay with the theme of the connections we Appalachians have with other cultures around the globe. These days, as most of us are staying home, the small little interactions we do have with other people have a whole new meaning. I think these very real human interactions are going to keep us sane in the weeks and months ahead. I know we should maintain our distance, but I'd like to believe we can still talk human to human and support the insanity we are all experiencing just by being kind and remembering that being apart doesn't have to mean we are closed off. This next story actually began with a casual conversation at a grocery store. One day, a few years ago, West Virginia Public Broadcasting producer Russ Barber started chatting with a very tall and jovial gentleman who was bagging groceries. His name is Anderson Charles. The two became friends. Russ eventually asked if he could share Anderson's story with our audience. It turns out that Anderson Charles wrote a memoir about his move from the West Indies to West Virginia. He grew up in a tightly knit community in Grenada, where neighbors often pitch in to help raise each other's kids and take care of people when they're sick. And though he grew to love his newly adopted home of Appalachia, he says he had a hard time finding that same feeling of community. The title of his book, I Am a Dirty Immigrant, comes out of an experience he had when coworkers at a telemarketing service labeled him a dirty immigrant. Russ Barber has this profile of Anderson Charles.
The reason why we have conflict with each other is because we don't know each other. We just know what everybody else tells us about each other.
Anderson Charles was born on the British-ruled island of Grenada, which gained independence from Great Britain in 1974. Today, Grenada is the smallest independent country in the Western Hemisphere. The tiny nation is made up of several isles in the southeastern Caribbean Sea and comprises 133 square miles with a population of about 110,000 people. Known as the Island of Spice, Grenada produces nutmeg and is one of the world's largest exporters of mace crops. Nearly half the residents identify themselves as Roman Catholics, but it was a Protestant minister who convinced the 7-foot Grenadian to accept a full basketball scholarship at the Baptist-affiliated Cumberland College in Whitley County, Kentucky.
At the time, we didn't have a university. So we either went to England, or we go to the University of the West Indies, or if we get, like me, get a scholarship to America, we come here. That was the main reason for coming. I wasn't searching for freedom. I wasn't searching for equality and all of that stuff. We had that there already.
Anderson says he wasn't ready for the many changes awaiting him when he arrived in Appalachia.
I landed in Kentucky and it was freezing. I wasn't prepared. I didn't have a jacket. I had one thin Caribbean-style shirt. So I was freezing.
A vegetarian accustomed to eating yams and other roots, Anderson was not prepared for American fast food.
I would get sick all the time because my body wasn't used to that processed food. Most of the stuff I eat, I cook, improvise with Caribbean recipes and stuff and put together.
He received yet another shock when attempting to communicate with local folk and failing to grasp subtle nuances.
Everybody was wondering, did I speak English? Yes, I spoke the Queen's English. You know, so they being from Kentucky and having that accent, I wasn't understanding a thing they were saying. I sort of went into a shell then.
Then he had to come to terms with American slang.
Where I'm from, it's like 86% African origin. So the slang is universal or national. There wasn't any difference in the slangs and stuff that we use. So coming to America, I thought, it's Americans. They all speak the same. No, they don't.
Then there was the fact that he was no longer in the majority when it came to race.
The best way to deal with something like that for me was to break away from cultural barriers and just deal with them as human beings. Then I realized they want the same thing I want. Here are these kids going to college. Education is important in my country, so I could communicate to them on that level, with them on that level. So that's what I had to do from the beginning.
Next, Anderson came face to face with American poverty.
Some people expect the streets to be paved in gold because we get this stuff about how good everything is here. And there was a place where I was in Kentucky called The Bottoms, and people lived there. We would never name a place The Bottoms, you know, we would name it like paradise because, you know, that's what we're aspiring to. But I started realizing, well, they're not that different. They want to work hard, you know, have a good living and live a normal, peaceful life. But here they are working from paycheck to paycheck just like me, just like we were in the islands.
Anderson says the realities of living in a third world country force communities to work together in order to survive.
I was raised in a village, so we had that village atmosphere. If you have to go to work, you don't have to go get somebody to babysit. You tell the neighbor, watch your kids. And I remember being home alone when I was 8 years old, and the neighbor just come over, hey, okay, I'm watching you, I'll tell your mother. And that would just keep us on the street and narrow. And we don't just call you, we go knock on your door, hey, are you okay? If somebody's sick, we'd go in and take care of them. If somebody doesn't have food, we would cook and bring food to the house.
Anderson says Grenadians in his community enjoyed a relatively low crime rate and simple way of life as he and other kids hung out at the beach, went snorkeling, and roamed the forest. He adds that despite growing up in such a laid-back environment, he and his siblings were well aware of the consequences of excess and misconduct.
You ever heard an old saying here in West Virginia where they said, go pick the whip outside? There was a specific tree called a tamarind tree. We say tamarind, but it's tamarind. It's a fruit, a really acidic sour fruit. But the branches on those, you could just tie it. It wouldn't break. That's what some people got whipped with.
He says school teachers were also very strict on Grenada, where the literacy rate today is 96% among people age 15 and older.
They're really strict about punctuality and stuff like that. Really strict about homework.
Anderson says students living on the same relatively small island were naturally drawn together, regardless their social and economic status.
It wasn't segmented into the cool kids, the nerdy kids, because everybody wore uniforms, everybody looked alike. So everybody sort of mingled.
Today, Anderson recommends mingling on a global scale.
Go talk to the villagers, because that's how you're going to know people. You know, don't go to a big city, don't go to Paris. That would be like going to New York. It's industrialized. You have to go talk to the people who live the culture and then listen to them, and you're going to realize that you're not that different. We are not that different.
With his book, I Am a Dirty Immigrant, Anderson brings readers face to face with the clashes of culture common in today's ever-transitioning world.
I always laugh at people when they think the immigration issues is just a big thing here. It's all over the world because everybody is looking for a safer place to be.
After a year at Cumberland College, Anderson married and moved to New York. He later relocated his family to Huntington, West Virginia, where he earned a degree in sociology at Marshall University in 2002. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Russ Barber.
That story originally aired in 2018. We checked in with Anderson Charles this week. He says he's doing okay. He's trying to maintain a sense of humor, and he's still working as a grocery store clerk and spending lots of quality time with his family. Again, his memoir is called I Am a Dirty Immigrant. You know, this past week, I've heard a few examples of some pretty fantastic acts of kindness. You probably have too. Next week, we'll be featuring some of these stories, so let us know if you've experienced a really great moment of people helping each other out. Email us at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @inappalachia. After the break, we'll go outside to explore why getting outside in nature, even just for a quick walk, can be so good for our physical and mental health.
My favorite things to do are probably run around and play with nature and make stuff with nature.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
I know we can't really gather together for live shows right now, and Mountain Stage has canceled its shows this month. So we wanted to listen to several of our favorite recordings of fiddle music from West Virginia. The song we're hearing now is actually a recording from a mountain stage show in 1991 of the late Melvin Wine playing a song called Cold Frosty Morning. Melvin Wine was a fiddler from Braxton County. He passed away in 2003, but he left a legacy as one of the most prolific fiddlers in West Virginia. Like many old-time musicians, he learned to play by listening in on informal jams and gatherings. This person-to-person style of learning music, art, cooking is called folkways. And here on Inside Appalachia, we celebrate the human power to teach each other. Another fiddler named John Morris, who lives in Clay County, is passing on his music to an apprentice named Jin Iskew. Here they are talking about the ways they each learned to play.
When I was learning old-time music, you had to go to the old people to learn it. You had to go into their homes, and you had to be respectful of them. You had to win their respect. You had to learn their ways. You had to be a friend to make a friend.
For me, the deeper I go into learning to play the fiddle, but not just learning to play the instrument, but the stories behind the tunes, it becomes less about myself and the disattachment that we have around us from our phones and the screens, and connects you to something bigger, to the past, to universal truths that have withheld the test of time. And it's just really nice to get outside of the hustle and bustle and just like sit down and be calm and listen for a while. I don't think we do that enough anymore.
What I liked about old time music, the thing that I liked the most is no longer here. It was the people that played it. The old people that I had so much fun with, and they were so much a part of my life. And now it's the young people. They're really great.
Again, that was fiddler John D. Morris and his fiddle student Jin Iskew. They're featured in a documentary from West Virginia Public Broadcasting called In Tune, produced by Russ Barber. The film is about the old-time music community in West Virginia and its influence on country music. We've posted a link on our website, wvpublic.org. If you're at home and you own pets, then you've been spending a lot more time with your furry friends. I know I have. But keep in mind that animals pick up on our stress. What you may need is some time together outside. Let's listen back now to a story that originally aired in 2018. As part of a series called Outside in Appalachia, health reporter and dog lover Kara Lofton explores how to safely enjoy outdoor recreation and why it may be so beneficial for our mental and physical health.
Lucy, come here.
Full disclosure, I am the proud millennial dog mom of four. Yes, you heard that right. Four dogs who absolutely love camping, hiking, and getting outside. So while working on this summer series, this idea of enjoying outdoor recreation with dogs seemed like a natural story. After all, studies have found that American millennials lead the country in pet ownership, fueling the $69 billion pet industry, an industry that has grown three times since the mid-90s. Which could be a good thing for our health. Recent studies have found that dog ownership is linked to everything from reducing allergies to counteracting negativity. A 2017 study of older adults found that dog owners are more active than those without, walking about 22 minutes more a day compared to non-dog owners. And walking is not only good for your mental and physical health, but also often gets you outside. And as we've explored earlier in the series, getting into nature has significant mental health benefits. Okay. By now, you might be thinking, great, I get it. Getting outside with pets is good. But the big question is, how do you do so safely?
Our pets, as a general rule, will do anything we ask them to.
That's Dr. Mark Freeman, an assistant professor of veterinary medicine at Virginia Tech.
And they will play as long as we ask them to play. They will continue trying as long as we keep asking them to keep trying. So it's very easy for a pet to become overheated and to become exhausted because their number one goal in life is to please us and make us happy. And as long as we keep throwing that frisbee, they're going to keep chasing it, even to the point of complete exhaustion.
Good job, Bug!
Good job, Bug!
Did you get it?
The biggest problem in the summer, he says, is heat exhaustion. Dogs, as you know, cool themselves by panting. Panting evaporates saliva, which cools the blood supply.
In the summertime, when it's hot, and especially when the humidity is high, that evaporation component doesn't occur. So they pant and pant, but there's no evaporation, so they don't actually cool themselves. So it's really important in the summer when the temperatures are high, when the humidity is high, that animals have access to shade, that they have access to lots and lots of fresh water.
This is particularly important, he says, for dogs with short faces like pugs, bulldogs, and certain pit bull breeds. The shorter snouts mean less effective cooling, and these dogs are even more likely to overheat. Johnny Warner is a Charleston-based vet. He says his biggest concern is not just dogs being too active, but the time between periods of activity, particularly leaving dogs in the car while you just run into the store for something or grab a bite to eat.
If you're doing outdoor recreation with your dog, you're likely getting there in a car. And the obvious one is just never leave your dog unattended in a closed car for any amount of time.
According to the American Veterinary and Medical Association, temperatures in a closed car can rise 19 degrees in the first 10 minutes. So, if the outside temperature is 70, they can rise to 89. If they start at 90, 109. And the more time that passes, the higher they rise. The other thing dramatically affected by rising temperatures is pavement. Freeman again.
And seeing really severe burns on the pads of the feet is not at all uncommon in the summer.
Which should be an incentive for you to stay off urban roads and get out to explore natural areas with your pet, such as parks, forest, and wooded paths. So, even though you might have to take some precautions to keep your best friend safe, science says it's worth it. And you never know, you might just improve your own health in the process.
Research has shown that going outside has a ton of health benefits. Increased physical activity and vitamin D levels, improved concentration, and you're more likely to feel happier. You may even heal faster. Next, Kara Lofton talks to a variety of experts about exercise, mental health, and nature.
A little over a decade ago, a psychologist named Richard Louve coined the term nature deficit disorder, meaning that human beings, especially children, are spending less time outdoors to the detriment of their mental and physical health. It's not an officially recognized medical disorder, but a wide variety of health professionals are embracing the idea that America's shift toward sedentary indoor lifestyles is harming our health. Nowadays, finding a group of kids playing outside together or families sitting on the front stoop is a rarity, and that's a really big deal.
Research has shown that people feel better. It improves our mood. Nature is a healer.
That's Scott Geller, a professor of psychology at Virginia Tech. For the last 50 years, he's been studying how psychology and the environment interact.
It's been shown clearly that nature, that the environment, increases subjective well-being. Now, if we're stuck behind the television indoors and we're sitting on that couch potatoes, we are missing opportunities to get up and moving. And of course, there's a health benefit to moving. And the environment naturally inspires us, once you're out there, is to keep moving.
Over at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Ross Arena is a professor of physical therapy who focuses on something called healthy living medicine.
Basically using exercise and nutrition to prevent and treat chronic disease with a much greater community focus, moving away from the hospital and more towards where people live, work, and go to school.
Arena says the health benefits of being active are not reserved for people training for marathons or gym rats.
Movement is highly beneficial. So instead of let's talk about exercise, let's talk about movement and actually thinking about three facets of that. So your steps per day, your sitting time, and then participation in a structured exercise program. And all of those are independently valuable. When you synergize them together, they're even more valuable.
And the easiest way to do that, he says, is just go outside. Walk around your block, do yoga on the back porch, visit the local park, and bring the whole family.
Like a lot of behaviors, you know, what you practice within the family is it tends to be what happens.
Earl Chambers is a researcher at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
So your dietary choices are reflective of whoever is the one making the meals in your home, and it's the same thing with activity. If you don't live in a family that is particularly active, then you tend to not be as active too.
Familial inactivity has resulted in an all-time high of childhood obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and asthma. Despite a myriad of outdoor recreation resources, Appalachia in particular has shockingly high numbers of these disorders. And so far, they're continuing to rise. For researcher Peter Thanos, getting outside and exercising could be a tool for preventing and treating addiction.
Chronic aerobic exercise had an impact on brain chemistry in a way that is consistent with what we know in terms of decreasing vulnerability for drug abuse. And this was something that was very, very profound.
Thanos is talking about research published last month in the online journal of the American College of Sports Medicine.
Because aerobic exercise has this effect at essentially restoring the balance of these brain chemicals, D1 and D2, in the brain, that same imbalance is what also is found in individuals who have either a vulnerability or a dependency for opioids and other drugs.
That was health researcher Peter Thanos talking about the benefits of spending time outside for people who struggle with substance use disorders. Kara Lofton originally reported that story in 2018. We're listening back to our series about why spending time outdoors can be so beneficial for our health, because doctors remind us that we can still be active during the coronavirus pandemic, and spending time exploring nature may be the safest way for many of us to do this. Many national parks across the country are closed due to health concerns, but many state and city parks remain open. And if they aren't too crowded, these could be good places for you to explore in the weeks ahead. If you parents out there manage to get your kids outside, you'll actually be bucking a national trend. About 10 years ago, the National Park Service noticed that fewer kids and families were using the parks, and they wanted to change that. So in 2009, they partnered with the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation to launch an initiative to help families unplug, get outside, and connect with local natural resources. Kara Lofton reports that the initiative, called Kids in the Park, soon expanded to include pediatricians who are trying to combat childhood obesity, diabetes, and excess screen time by writing scripts for kids to go outside.
6-year-old Hannah sits at her dining room table munching on an apple as she describes making fairy dust from leaves and seeing a turtle while at a Kids in the Park event earlier this year.
My favorite things to do are probably run around and play with nature and make stuff with nature.
Her mom, pediatrician Erin Reagan, sits beside her listening. Reagan is involved with the National Park RX movement. The idea is to write prescriptions for kids to get unplugged, go outside, take a walk, play with dirt, get moving. It's something she says she's conscientious about with her patients as well as her own children.
If I have a kid who is overweight, a kid who is spending a lot of time in front of the TV, we ask about screen time at every checkup. I'll make the offer. And then we just have a placard up in our waiting room. And so anybody who's interested, who notices that and wants to participate, can ask about it, and we're happy to have them participate as well.
Reagan says from her perspective as a pediatrician, kids aren't moving nearly enough, and they're spending far too much time in front of screens. As a result, they're restless and have a harder time managing their emotions.
everything sets them off. I don't think like they feel like they're in control almost. They don't know what to do with themselves.
The science, she says, shows that kids who move more focus better and maybe even learn better. At Okanichi Mountain State Natural Area in Hillsboro, North Carolina, Kids in the Park director Jason Euros is walking through one of the Kids in the Park track trails. He stops at a colorful sign where two mascots, a dog, track, and a dragonfly, are depicted in bright colors, explaining the different activities kids can do.
It attracts kids to want to come over here and look at this sign. And then you've got the directions of the map telling you how long this hike is, and these are the trails that are in this park, and while you're hiking the trails, use these different brochures on your hike in order to, you know, learn about the pond life or the trees or, you know, go on a hide-and-seek scavenger hunt.
As kids complete a hiker brochure, they can register online for little gifts such as stickers or a bandana. Additionally, if a child has participated in the Park Prescriptions program, when they register the activity or hike, their pediatrician gets a message and that information is added to his or her medical file. The hope, he says, is that if they can get kids excited about getting outdoors early in life, it will become a life habit.
Try to make our trails 1 to 2 miles in length so that they're not overly strenuous and kids have a good time and they see different things and then want to do it again.
It begins to rain, and we duck under some trees to meet up with Sean Higgins, the education manager for North Carolina State Parks.
Kids have been throwing rocks in streams and running through the forest for tens of thousands of years. And kids more and more are indoors. They're indoors more than, you know, any previous generation. They're spending time on video games and on screens.
Higgins says he thinks a lot about what kids get from video games. And he thinks it's a feeling of control, getting to make decisions without an adult steering them.
I think kids can get those same things outdoors. I think things like the Kids in Parks track trails give kids the opportunity to make decisions. You know, which topics do I want to explore on the trail? It gives kids the opportunity to achieve things. They can earn some really cool prizes for doing this.
And it seems to be working. Kids in the Park director, Euros, says 54% who participate are first-time visitors to a park, and 11% of kids were first-time hikers. Pediatrician Reagan has only been writing scripts for about 6 months and says for her, it's too soon to see if the program is having an impact on obesity, diabetes, and screen time. But anything that encourages kids to get outside and get excited about it is a win. She says she realizes getting outside can be really tough for working families, but making an effort makes a difference.
Right. My husband and I both work, and so we really do our best to spend a lot of time on the weekends doing things, getting out of the house, not being inside and just plopping in front of the TV yet again.
Although there are Kids in the Parks locations all up and down the Blue Ridge, only one park in West Virginia currently participates, Harper's Ferry National Park in the Eastern Panhandle. Euros says he'd love to have some more West Virginia parks on board. All it takes is for the park to reach out and say, hey, we'd like to participate.
Even if there isn't a park near your home, that doesn't mean you can't get outside. Remember, even just a few minutes walking around your neighborhood can be helpful to get a little perspective and to de-stress. And if you live someplace where you can see stars, it can be therapeutic to take a step outside tonight. For the final part in our series about getting outside, Kara Lofton reports that restoring healthy sleep patterns, which turns out is pretty critical to health, may begin with getting outside at night.
At Blackwater State Park, Pauletta Cousins is leading a night hike.
So that is actually a natural resource up there above us, and it's disappearing at the speed of light. So if you look at the United States or even the world from outer space, well, in the United States, you'll see that the whole eastern United States is all brightly lit up. You can see it from space. There's one little small dark spot on the east. Where's that?
West Virginia is one of the darkest spots on the eastern seaboard, a fact that could be good news for our health.
When it's dark, we're naturally supposed to be sleeping. And light is actually messing up a chemical that we have in our body to make us be healthy individuals.
Exposure to light suppresses the secretion of melatonin, a hormone that influences circadian rhythms. And there's some early evidence that lower melatonin levels might explain the association with cancer. Despite being one of the darkest spots on the East Coast, West Virginia ties with New York, with almost 40% of residents reporting less than 7 hours of sleep a night. Not getting enough sleep is associated with metabolic problems, issues with insulin resistance, and weight gain, according to the National Institutes of Health. Interestingly, nationwide, sleep patterns look similar to maps of obesity and diabetes prevalence. So, if your circadian rhythms are messed up, how do you reset them?
We did a study, actually a series of three studies, where we used camping essentially as a tool to escape the light exposure that you get in modern cities.
That's Chris Deppner, a postdoctoral fellow in the sleep lab of the University of Colorado Boulder. He was part of a study to see if we escaped all electrical light, what would that do to our bodies and our biological clocks?
Over a week, our biological clocks basically tune themselves to the timing of sunrise and sunset. So that means during the normal biological or environmental night, that's when our bodies were trying to sleep, and during the day, that's when we were supposed to be awake.
They then tested the hypothesis over just a weekend of camping.
And we saw that about 70% of that effect happened over just the weekend. So that means when you think about that, like on Monday morning, then when you wake up, your body's going to be more in tune with the environmental cycle versus perhaps if you're living in the electrical lighting environment, where you could be more in tune with the electrical environment.
While light of any kind can suppress the secretion of melatonin, blue light at night, such as the kind found on phones, computers, and TVs, does so more powerfully. A Harvard study found that when people were exposed to blue versus green light, blue light suppresses melatonin for about twice as long as the green light and shifted circadian rhythms by twice as much. What isn't clear from the research is whether spending more time outside does the trick, or if simply dimming the lights in your home and turning off the TV, cell phone, and other electronic devices a couple hours before bed would suffice. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
As the world grapples with the coronavirus, many of us may be out of our routines. Maybe we're trying to answer email with kids at home, or working late to accommodate their at-home schedules. Maybe we're worried about loved ones or our financial well-being in this uncertain time. The anxiety is real. West Virginia University Assistant Research Professor Julie Brzezinski-Lewis says one way to deal with that anxiety is with compassion and meditation. While many of us are practicing social distancing to help slow the spread of the virus, tapping into our compassion for others may help manage coronavirus anxiety. Reporter Brittany Patterson spoke with Brzezinski-Lewis about how thinking about others during this time can actually help us all feel less alone. Here's an excerpt of their conversation, which was recorded on Zoom.
What is compassion meditation?
Compassion meditation is part of mindfulness, but it takes it a step further and does an imaginative exercise where you purposefully cultivate a positive feeling of compassion. It can be for yourself, it can be for others. There's, you know, different types of compassion meditation, but they often follow a step-by-step sequence of starting with someone you really care about, and, you know, just thinking of them makes you smile, and wishing them happiness and wishing them joy and easing of their suffering. And from there, you can step to other people or maybe yourself if you have trouble having compassion. compassion for yourself.
Tell us about the role this can play in a time like we're facing right now, where things seem really uncertain and fluid.
My recommendation when I was asked about it earlier by WVU was based on my own experience of also being stressed. And what happens for me when I'm stressed is I sometimes get a sense of claustrophobic anxiety, where I just start to spin a little bit. And I think that that happens in general. In neuroimaging, you can actually see a network of self-rumination start to fire up. And compassion is sort of like a little escape from that circuit. So we did a study in long-term meditating monks who are really good at doing this meditation and found that, you know, that they were activating pro-social areas. So our brains are wired to be social. And this is a pretty weird time because we're wired to be social and we're all kind of isolated. But if we think about the fact that all those other people are out there and they're all, you know, kind of trying to make it work and trying to you know, get around their own anxiety and, oh, I wish them well. Then you start to activate that pro-social network, even when you're home isolating.
It's like we're all anxious together.
We're all anxious together. Exactly. And that's actually... There's some solidarity in that. And the posts that I often see on social media that I think are quite uplifting are related to that. Hey, we're all in this together. You know, we're all going to, you know, do our best to help others if we can. Those types of things are very uplifting. And why? It's because we can think of other people. And that takes the emphasis off our own little claustrophobic misery.
Are there techniques that could help us be more mindful? And does it take a lot of time?
No, and that's kind of the beauty. If you're in a moment where you're just noticing, you know, a tree branch, a leaf, you know, a reflection in a pool of water, all those little things kind of take the mind off our anxiety and place it on something that can be quite beautiful. That's often used, for example, in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. You realize, you think, oh, I'm just anxious all day long. I'm just depressed all day long. Well, you know, there are moments where you might see something beautiful. And if you become a little bit aware and remind yourself, maybe even with a little dot on your computer screen, you could, you know, put a little reminder that comes up on your phone to say, hey, breathe. And then when you breathe, you look around and you use your senses. Hey, you know, I smell dinner cooking. That smells really good. Or, you know, I see the little bird, you know, perched there on the tree and I can't believe, you know, it's spring and, you know, all the birds are happy and they don't know what's going on. And I just enjoy that. Or my little kid, you know, wow, look at their smile. If you just notice how beautiful something is, go into that a little bit more and then imagine sharing that with others. So if you want to turn that into a compassion meditation, you could just imagine, hey, may all enjoy the beauty of the beautiful bird outside, or may all enjoy the beauty of a child's smile, or what, or a funny video, or whatever you experience during the day. You can just say, may all who are kind of anxious like me today enjoy, you know, this beautiful bird.
I imagine a lot of us are feeling a lot of anxiety. We're in situations that are new and changing. What advice would you offer to people as they try to navigate staying calm and taking care of their mental health during this time?
Over and over, I would just say, be gentle with yourself. If you did this practice and then all of a sudden you find yourself angry or uptight or anxious or stressed throughout the day and you feel at any point the word should come up, please be gentle, because all of us are struggling and that's going to happen. You're going to feel stressed.
So as we just heard, finding moments for ourselves doesn't have to take long. Close your eyes and imagine for a few seconds you're outside listening to the birds sing. Here, we'll do it together. Ready? 3, 2, 1.
And
And if you want, you can listen to a 10-minute guided meditation led by Julie Brzezinski-Lewis. We've posted it on our website, wvpublic.org. Don't forget to send us your stories about people helping each other. We'll be talking about compassion and mutual aid next week here on Inside Appalachia. Till then, thanks for joining me as we travel throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Appalachia Health News, a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health and Charleston Area Medical Center. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music in today's show was provided by Melvin Wine, John Morris, and Jen Eskew. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glynis Board. She also edited our show this week and is like 38 weeks pregnant. Oh my gosh, Glynis, you rock. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy helped promote our show. And to all the engineers and board ops and IT folks who are helping keep West Virginia Public Broadcasting on the air, you guys are amazing. Thank you so much for your hard work and coming in day after day. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our Inside Appalachia newsletter so you never miss a show. And if you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all our stories at wvpublic.org. And you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Roxy Todd. Jessica Lilly will be back in a couple of weeks. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.